My name is Jeffrey Kahn, and I'm the host of Digital Oil and Gas, the podcast that looks at the impact of digital technology on the oil and gas industry. If you want to discuss this week's topic further, or just stay in touch, you can always reach me at Jeffrey Kahn on Twitter or at jeffreykahn.com. My name is Jeffrey Kahn, and welcome to another episode of Digital Oil and Gas. I'm joined today by Brad Rabus, who's a executive with a technology company based in Edmonton called Materity. Brad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Today's discussion, I've always been fascinated about the construction industry and its use of digital innovation. Stemming principally from my time in Australia, where the construction of the LNG projects was plagued by cost overruns and delays and so forth. And McKinsey has published some of their research, which says the construction industry is a laggard when it comes to digital innovation. So I thought, why not talk to someone who has a specialization, a company that has a specialization in addressing this question?
Well, thank you very much. That's our one of our main focuses at our company. So we actually have two products at Materity, one that's focused on the construction side. So essentially everything that's captured during that right up until the last turnover and it goes into operations. And then that's where we have a separate program that handles risk-based inspection and asset management across large companies as well, too.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into what we see, some of the issues are that are problematic in the construction industry. So, you know, if you had to say here's the top three things that the industry really has to struggle with,
what would those be? Only three? I can go for a while on this one. But the big ones are right now. Of course, you got compliance with regulators across it. When you're capturing all the documentation and everything coming from the project, you want to make sure you're meeting all the requirements set out by whatever regulating body that you have there.
Well, there's got to be more than one regulator, I think. So even for major construction projects, there would be, I think about a pipeline project, water, environmental, land disturbance, safety and integrity, and so forth.
Pressure, materials.
Yeah, right.
Everything and all the construction quality that goes into it. So, for example, the welding and torquing on bolts and everything like that. Now, those things are usually just captured on paper. And like you said, the industry is more of a laggard to this. I'll get into more detail on that. The other big one is traceability of the materials. So a lot of the regulators are starting to go after companies. Ensuring that the DNA of what the actual material was used, so essentially everything about where the ingot was poured at the foundry, all the strength testing, the grade of steel.
Why are they interested in traceability of steel? We don't do that for cars, do we?
We do a bit on that, on the car side. The car side is, a lot of it is not a pressure vessel.
It's just strength as opposed to operating under pressure.
Correct. So if you look at it, you'll have a pipeline. They have to know that the grade of steel that's used for the entire length of it is consistent. And you have to prove that out. Now, the problem is the steel that's manufactured and it comes from the foundry is set at whatever grade it is when they pour it. Now, there's some inconsistencies depending on who's doing it and where it's coming from.
Which foundry,
yep. What the mine is. Mm-hmm. And then you can see what the carbon content of it is. But once it starts leaving the actual foundry and it moves to milling and fabrication and coating along the way, each time it moves through that, it moves through another silo of data.
Those silos are the different companies that are in that chain?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the problem that you get into is as it moves through this chain, you can lose traceability on it. So they might remove a stencil as they grind it down or sandblast it to get it ready to coat, and then they reapply that stencil.
But this problem's been solved in the food industry, though, I think, or maybe pharmaceuticals, if you remember the Tylenol scare from many, many years ago, and the regulator at that time said, all right, no more. we need to know exactly where the drugs were manufactured, which factory they came from, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Is that the regulators are now insisting that this be done for pressurized steel in the some dimensions of the construction industry, notably pipelines?
Yes, and right. And there was a number of incidences. San Bruno, which is in the public sphere, I can talk about it, is a big one. It kind of basically boils down like this.
So what happened in that one? What was this?
It was out in California. A pipe burst. Subsequent explosion and fire took the lives of some of the people out there.
Oh, no.
And the governor and the regulators came down hard on the owner-operator. And when they started doing the investigation into it, the pipe that burst, the first thing they always ask as a regulator is, where's the documentation?
Yeah, show me. Was this a weld or was it a steel problem or when
exactly.
Was it installed and when was the last time you looked at it?
All
the usual questions. So,
show me the
document.
Show me the documentation.
Yeah.
And prove this thing out. Well, PG&E, the company that Pacific Gas and Energy, the company that had the explosion, basically rented out the Cow Palace in San Jose, filled it up with pallets full of banker boxes, and sifted every one of them to try to find one MTR, one material testing report for that pipe. Millions of man hours later, they had none. They couldn't dig it up.
They couldn't find it.
No.
So they couldn't prove that they had tested the steel prior to installation to mm-hmm. assure that under pressure it wouldn't burst.
Correct. So when they actually dug up the pipe and they took a look at it, the coating didn't even match the coating on the original pipe.
Oh.
And so they subsequently
problem number two.
Problem number two. And then they did a little more research into it, and a few years before that, they actually found out a contractor had come in, and they had a section of pipe that was looking a little rough. It had corrosion or some sort of issue.
Yep.
And so they cut it out, and the contractor decided he was going to try to save the company some money because he just happened to have a chunk of steel laying in the back of his yard. He's like, same wall thickness, same size. I can weld it in. You don't have to roll a new piece of steel.
It looks the same.
It looks,
right?
it looks the same,
but it
exactly.
might not have the same performance characteristics.
And that was exactly the problem. So, of course, it failed at the weakest point, and they suffered the consequences.
Was
and
it,
they're still
it,
suffering.
Was it a gas leak or was it the liquids or what?
Gas.
It? Gas.
Yeah, and so it was a fairly big
fireball.
Yeah. And anytime people are, die. Of course, that blood is used to write the next code in the book.
Yep.
And that's kind of where the gas rule, or the mega rule, as they like to call it, in the U.S. is starting to come in.
When was this event?
2011, I believe.
Oh, so not that long ago.
No. So they did ask the API to come out with standards, or like, how do we fix this?
Mm.
API 1177 came out on construction quality management systems.
Yep.
And essentially said, you've got to trace this, that material, and not lose traceability from where it's forged right through to where it lies in the ground.
From point of forging. So that could be a steel mill in Taiwan, right? Mm-hmm. All the way through from that point of manufacture to all the ships that touch it, all the trucking firms that touch it, the laydown yards, the contractors doing the installation.
And this is where people...
Otherwise, traceability is broken because you don't know where
yeah, and there's a difference between traceability and trackability. Trackability is like that where you're just kind of looking at the logistics of it as it moves through the chain, saying it went from here to here. It's like following your package on
FedEx
or
Amazon.
Now, the traceability of it is where was it built, what's all in there. It's that little packing slip that goes with it and the unique serial number on that item as it gets to you and making sure that it's not lost as it's moving through that logistic chain.
Mm.
The problem is in the industry, you're grinding on these things, you're coating them.
Yep.
You're constantly moving that in each.
And they're big, they're heavy. Right, right.
Yeah.
If you put a stick a label on it, it's not like an Amazon box where you can put your barcode on it. It'll still be there in the morning. It doesn't quite work that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's more demanding.
And so that's one of the biggest issues. And because of that, the regulators are looking at all sorts of ways of carrot and stick to try to enforce this. Next year, I was actually just at a FEMSA conference down in the U.S., and they're taking the lead on this. So I know the Canadian regulators will be coming up behind it with the new CSA standards, but we're always a year or two behind on that. But it is coming. But essentially, there's been a number of incidences, and every time the FEMSA regulators in the U.S. or DOT investigate, they're running into situations where we don't know what this material is. And it's disturbed them enough that they're trying to get this solved. And so a lot of the companies are jumping down there to try to get it.
And what happens, if you went and looked at the pipeline network in North America, there's easily 1 million kilometers of pipeline.
Oh, for sure.
There's lots and lots of pipeline. Much of it predates 2011, if not the bulk of it.
Mm-hmm.
So are the regulations actually backdating into the brownfield installations, or is it just for the greenfield going forward?
No, they're looking to go back. Everybody's trying to figure out the solution to this.
Mm.
At the conference that I just was at, the regulator was suggesting they're looking at a 15-year period for people to catch up and identify everything.
Do a sort of a phase-in.
There's no real grandfathering. Eventually, after they said they're looking at the carrot and stick method, one of the ones is, they still haven't come out with the official law, so this is all...
Yep, all under development.
Under development.
Yep.
And lots of rumors. One of the ones was, if you can prove out your line, every stick of pipe, valve, everything along the line, and have a grade of steel and what it can get up to, they're looking to allow you to cut into your maximal allowable operating pressure, which means more fluid, more gas through the line, equals more money over the life of the project.
Mm.
On the opposite side, on the stick side of things, they're looking at either reducing your maximum allowable operating pressure, and the word of half has come around a couple times. Yes.
That's a throughput.
That's
a throughput. 50%, yeah.
Yeah,
that
is
very
savage.
Painful.
Yeah, and so as soon as you start touching money of these companies, you know, eyebrows get up and people are starting to move pretty quickly. So companies are getting ahead of it, but it, like you said, it's a mountain. And so our company is more focused on eliminating it at the source and providing a whole bunch of other benefits along.
Well, this gets directly into the question of how does digital innovation play a role here? because what you're highlighting is that one of the, as the regulator is evolving their thinking on this, they're seeking trackability and traceability, high quality documentation of the as-built, and those need to be readily available in the event of an incident so that you can demonstrate compliance with the regulations, but also demonstrating compliance as you're building the pipe during construction. So digital must play some kind of a role, given that what we're talking about here is data about the pipe that's gone in, not just the pipe itself.
Yeah.
So what is the role of digital in all of this?
So I'll kind of give you a little background on my history. When I graduated from high school, I'm from Bentley, Alberta, small town in between Sylvan and Gull Lake.
Beautiful Bentley, Alberta. Thriving metropolis.
Well, I grew up on a farm out there, so when I graduated, I had no clue what I wanted to do. And I asked my dad, you know, what should I do? And he goes, well, do you know what you want to take in college or university? I said, no, I don't really know yet. He goes, okay, well, go do things that will teach you what you don't want to do. So he told me to go work oil field. And so 18 years old, I was out running a hydrovac out in the middle of minus 40, covering myself in mud on doing locates for pipelines and construction. Mm. And so I got to get the taste of that at that bottom level and decide, well, I don't want to stick that out, but I do appreciate it. So I got into computer technology after.
Ah, right.
And conveniently, when I finished and graduated.
This is the pre-digital era.
This is, well, it was digitizing era.
Digitizing, yeah. 80s?
Late 90s.
Late 90s, yeah.
So the problem was is when I graduated, though, the dot-com bust happened.
Oh, yes, 2001, boom. The bottom fell out.
Yep. I graduated, the class before me, everybody had a job waiting for them when they got there. Me, not so much.
Yeah.
So then I'm back out, I'm paving, I'm working geotechnical, I'm doing quality control for concrete.
Yes, classic Albertans survival mode.
Exactly.
When the economist takes a swing.
Mm-hmm.
Albertans hop to and get into the day to day of making things happen for themselves.
Exactly, you got it.
Yep.
And so they, all these jobs that I took along the road, got me experience and understanding of all these field issues. And a lot of it, when I looked at it, the industry just didn't have that forward looking. Momentum of getting past something like an Excel sheet. Everybody was an Excel guru in any company that I was at. They had one or two of them that would make some sort of a template and people would use those.
Mm.
And
it's still true, by the way.
It's still true.
Yeah. Most of many oil and gas companies, what I would call their signature solution, their signature way of doing something,
mm-hmm.
is often coded in Excel.
And
tied to a specific individual and all of the version control issues that go along with that.
And what blew me away was eventually worked my way through a whole bunch of other jobs. Ended up working on a large SAGD project in the double-digit billion-dollar mark. And we were working on construction for it. And it just absolutely blew my mind that we had major contractors, a major owner-operator on site, multinationals, and we were using Excel sheets across everything.
Mm.
And it was...
when was this?
This would have been 2011 to 2013.
So not that long ago. Again, just within the decade.
Yeah. And things haven't really progressed since then. And so I started looking at it, and I kind of had to define some basic kind of steps where people are solving these problems with documentation and data capture on construction by looking at types of generations they've went through. Because every industry has followed kind of the same pattern, except this industry. It's stuck on generation two. So if you look at generation one is just doing it by paper. So take the example of accounting. Accounting, pre-computer, it's all paper ledgers. You're doing quarterly reports because it literally takes you 3 months to try to figure where the hell you were.
To close your books, yeah.
Yeah. So then, you know, people moved on to local machines, very similar to doing it on Excel. You're doing it on one spreadsheet, trying to figure out where you're at.
Mm.
Inefficiencies there, but greater efficiency than the paper. And then people move to where they're documenting it, and we're trying to put it into essentially a digital filing cabinet, right? So now it's not sparse individual spreadsheets around. You're bringing it into one filing cabinet, but it's now just a capture of many files, right? So there's nothing that really ties them together. And then generation four is where you actually move to a full database and application integration. And so I look at the construction industry, and I would say 95 to 99% are still stuck at generation two. And there's a golden handcuff type of thing that people look at it as everybody has Excel on their machine. So it's almost free in their minds. And it solves the riddle of a construction management.
It's easy to use. It doesn't require a ton of training to kind of, you know, type in a formula into an Excel sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology is quite mature. But, you know, if you take an industry that is surrounded by an ever more vigilant regulator,
mm-hmm.
Construction materials, which are getting more and more sophisticated in their own right, an industry itself, though, which is stuck in second gear in terms of using digital solutions or technologies, then you have the formula is a low productivity, high cost, slow industry. which is, you know, at odds with where the rest of the world is, the rest of the world is going.
And I look at it, you know, and I hate to use tech terms, but they make sense to me, and it drives some of my contemporaries nuts. But we use latency as a measure of asking a question and getting a response. So there's latency on your network, you know, how long it takes for Facebook to load, for example, after you click the
Or if you're talking to a, you know, talking on your mobile phone internationally, you know, you've got a line delay, you've got that slight lag as people are talking. So that's latency, I get that.
And, you know, like in other industries, like if you look at like an online search, if you're over 500 milliseconds, you see a 20% drop in traffic and revenue. Now, this is from Gartner's
research and analysis into this. What's 500 milliseconds? Is that a half a second?
Half a second.
Half a second. So a half a second delay on a Google search is sufficient for 20% of the people doing the search to lose interest.
Yes. That's how low our
tolerance is for latency. Yeah.
And it gets even crazier when you get down to like VR or AR, virtual reality or augmented reality. If you've got a 7 millisecond delay, that can cause motion sickness in the user. Mm. And, you know, they can't, it's not acceptable to go above that. And then when you get into the new industrial IoT things, so robots and everything, you're looking at sub-milliseconds.
Yeah, 7 milliseconds for a drone to respond to a, you know, instruction to do something could be catastrophic.
Mm.
So try to imagine a, I'm just thinking about a construction process where I would say to a, quote, firm I'm dealing with to build something. Mm-hmm. My latency is measured in days. Actually.
Or months,
yeah. Here's what I need. I'll get back to you next month with a quote or here's a response, yeah.
Well, and from like my experience, and we did with one of the large owner operators in Canada and the U.S., we did a large project with them. If you look at the project turnover, which is gathering all the documentation for it and passing it on to long-term integrity and into, onto the regulators to get everything up and running, you're looking at weeks to months. And on this particular project, they had budgeted using a Generation 2 type system with your Excel sheets and everything. Everybody accepts that latency is months, and they were budgeted for 3 months. Now, our system that we've created on our side of the database and gathers everything into one cookie jar and is standardized across all contractors.
Right, single source of truth.
Single source of truth through
the whole supply line.
Yeah.
So latency could drop to near zero.
Well, it does drop. There's still people that have to go through things, but as far as like turnover, actually gathering all the documentation, making sure it's there,
yep,
and getting off a site quickly as the contractor, we were able to knock that down by about 90%.
90%?
90%. Just for the fact that our system had everything captured, it was reviewed, it was complete and traceable, and they were missing nothing. In the old way, you're trying to track down a report that was in some guy's email that was on the project 2 months ago, and now he's in Mexico.
In an Excel spreadsheet, on his mail system, and you know you can't find it, and you haven't got the search terms, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So you now put it into one structured environment and enable everyone to contribute to it.
Exactly.
There must be privacy or some considerations associated with some suppliers not wanting other suppliers to know what they're doing. Is that fair to say? In this industry, privacy isn't as much of a concern as it might be, say, in the Facebook world.
There is privacy built into it. So like our application that we've built compartmentalizes.
So you see what you need to see.
You see what you need to see, yeah.
Okay.
So for example, when we import non-destructive testing data and then link it to welding data, the non-destructive testing app does not allow their users to see any details outside of the weld list that they're going to be attaching their inspection results to. They don't get to see any of the labor equipment material type data. They don't get to see any of the scheduling.
Right.
They don't get into anybody else's reports. It's compartmentalized.
That's a big plus.
We had to make sure we did that to basically win over everybody.
Yeah. Yep.
So our company is third party, to all of this. We only do software. We do not provide inspection services. We don't do any of that. So it allows you to have a system that you can use across the board on your construction without tying into other services that you would be forced to use.
Yeah, you're not locked in, if you like. You think about this as a I mean, one of the worries I have with the industry is that if I'm an oil and gas company, for instance, if I surrender too much of my information to some of my suppliers, the worry I have is that the suppliers will be in a position to turn the tables and extract rent from me because they have a specialized insight into my own operations that even I might not have.
Yeah,
so that's the concern or the worry that certainly some producers have said to me this is troublesome for them.
Yeah, and that's like our business model, like our main focus for companies is owner operators. So owner operators, when they use our service, so it's based off of per diem user license cost.
Okay,
and so it scales with the project and then scales back down.
So you're not locked in.
You're not locked in.
All right. So as long as you're building, you just bring users on board to contribute to the database or get access to the information. They're paying for their usage, and then once they're done, they're done.
Yeah. And we basically set up a private cloud for you, which just means someone else's server. So a server that we have in a secure location.
Yep.
We work with a number of hosting companies. We do SOC 2 reports, which essentially provides security audits that allow you to host anything.
You don't have to. So if you're the owner operator, you don't have to stand up a private computer system on your own. You just go onto this cloud structure, mm-hmm. bring your users on board, only for the duration of the project.
Yep.
So where does the data go at the end? So if I'm imagining a scenario where I'm the owner, I'm going to build this pipe. I'm now going to operate this pipe for decades. I'm going to want all of this traceability information that was captured during the construction cycle. So if you like, it gets handed over from the construction into the operate phase. Mm-hmm. So how does that work?
So number of options. At the end of turnover, depending on what your long-term records keeping system is.
Yeah, I might have SAP or Maximo or whatever for my own purposes, yeah.
Yeah, so essentially we can, and if you're running SharePoint or pods or something like that, we can do database-to-database transfers of all of that. Now, we create a large buffet of data in the system, greater than what pods would be able to handle, but you can export GIS information, asset information, costing information, anything that we're capturing on that side of actuals into whatever database that you have on the other side, as well as you can store it in our database and leave it as is on the cloud. Or if you want to have a archive server sitting behind your own architecture, we can
offload the data and put it into that.
Correct.
Archive.
So the only reason that we keep the cloud one is to ensure quality to the end user. So we want to make sure that there's no issues with connectivity for the guys in the field. There are grassroots users, and if they're not happy, then the data doesn't move through the system.
So another challenge there is if I'm building a pipe in a remote area, mm-hmm. Am I able to do this offline, or do I have to be? Do I need network connectivity for the field team to be able to access the database?
So our system's built in a briefcase model. When we first started building this, we were doing the design with Enbridge for the Northern Gateway pipeline. So we knew that we'd be in situations.
Yeah, in the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah, literally
there's no coverage. There is no coverage. Yeah.
So we basically had to make it where all the data that you are going to require to work through multiple days even is downloaded to your device, do all your inspections and everything else. And then as you receive or get back into internet coverage,
you can open your briefcase and load the data back into the
exactly
database, right.
And download the latest.
Right.
So that way, revisioning is always updated. The guy always has his latest and greatest welding procedures, asset lists, everything like that, as well as he is always pushing up his reports.
Yeah.
They're not sitting on his local laptop.
Yeah, trapped and offline forever. Yeah, exactly. So he's kind of solved for that problem. That's probably one of the bigger concerns I think the industry continues to have. And one of the things that I see that blocks a lot of digital innovation is the lack of a robust, reliable telecommunication services to the oil and gas fields is lacking. And the consequence is lack of update, lack of take-up of some digital solutions.
And when it kind of goes back to a model that we worked on at a fracking company back in the mid-2000s, a similar issue with their RFP of data capture from all of their field staff doing fracks, cementing, everything out in the field, getting the price book and getting all of the engineering details to the guy in the field, and then also adding, because you don't have connection to the internet, also adding all of the actuals of what happened in the field, what the billing was, and then pushing that back up to the server. So it was something that we'd already solved back in the mid-2000s. What really took this to the next level was mobile devices.
Tablets and cell phones. Yeah, this concept of briefcasing, I think it's a great term actually, but this concept of briefcasing actually makes a lot of sense and solves for this specific issue. Right?
Yeah.
So it might not solve for the issue of, say I've got a downhole device and I want near real-time connectivity back to, say, a control room in some town in Alberta or back here to Calgary. But this would certainly allow, in this sort of more project-oriented world, you to be able to download what you need, go do your work, and then sync up when you get back into coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's really powerful.
There's just the mobile nature of people and the acceptance of the devices that we all carry on us now.
Yeah.
when we did our research on this, we found that the average age of a person that was doing the inspections on this was 55. It's going to be coming down soon as a lot of people are starting to retire
out.
But we did find that most people over 55, about 95% of them use iPhones. So we went with the Apple-based tablets, the minis.
Right.
Best battery life, best hardware.
Built-in camera, lots of software availability for it, developer kit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Could do a lot of fun things.
The key piece is user acceptance, though.
Mm-hmm.
They look at it just as a bigger phone. So it puts older gentlemen on the same level as a guy that's 25. They're doing the exact same thing. It's the same thing they've been using forever. So we had a lot of people that would tell us, I don't know how to get my picture off of my phone onto this Excel sheet and copy and paste it.
Yep.
And they'd be bugging their children at 9 o'clock.
And I did this at work today, but I need to get this. How do I do this, Johnny?
Yeah.
Get this photo of a pipe I've installed onto my into my Excel model.
Oh, and right. It caused family frustration. Like, it was a legit issue, and when we solved that by just having it integrated, it would attach the pictures to the database and sync up, and they had to do nothing. It would automatically put it in the reports.
Far more interesting, yeah.
Oh yeah, we were able to shave off 1 to 2 hours of a field guy's daily
lost evening, effectively, or take time out of the day.
Yeah. Well, I had a number of older gentlemen that were telling me I got to buy them an extra case of beer because now they've got an extra couple hours to have a beer later on and watch the hockey game. So
nothing like a little time saving.
Yeah.
I understand you have a conference coming up, which is going to take
It's the first week of March.
First week of March.
You can find details about it on metegrity.com. That's metegrity.com.
What'll happen at the conference? What happens there?
So we have our user conference where we bring everybody in to go over where we're at right now with the software, get feedback from all the users, as well as show off to prospective companies what's coming up, how we can help them. There's going to be workshops. You get to work with companies that have already made that leap on the construction side with us to learn best practices and see how it's helped them out. So I'd mentioned Enbridge in there. They're one of our staunch supporters. We have a few others. We're going to have everybody in there. They will also be doing the vision software on the long-term integrity side. That has a humongous following that's been going for 25 years, that software. So we get people from all over the world. There's a bunch of people coming from Africa, I believe, on this one as well, too.
So there'll be a multiple track, sounds like, in the integrity track and this construction track. Is that how that'll be set up?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. So if someone is interested, obviously, they can go hit the website, and I assume it's open to anyone who's interested in this topic.
Yep.
It's not restricted to people who are currently customers, so...
Yeah, anybody can come.
Anyone can come and register and see what's going on in this particular world.
Exactly.
So who should come? I mean, if you wanted to say, you should go to this, who would you say you should come and check this out?
I would say anybody that... definitely owner-operators.
Of
pipelines.
Pipelines specifically.
Construction.
Yeah. Yep.
So... We're moving into a number of other industries by demand of customer. So we're going to be getting into fabrication. We're already starting to design and work that out. And then moving on to larger plant construction. And those, we want to start working with more owner-operators on that to see exactly more of a broad spectrum of what everybody wants into the system, get that feedback. So if you're interested on that side, if you're interested on pipeline or offshore, come on in. Construction managers, quality managers, project managers. There is definitely savings and all sorts of benefits that you're going to be able to see out of this system by actually getting in and seeing what's going on there. Conveniently, at the same time, actually NASCAR is happening the weekend before, so if you show up a couple days early...
You can see, say, check out some NASCAR activity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It should be a lot of fun.
Vancouver and the Knights, and I think Calgary and the Knights are playing as well, too, so...
In Las Vegas at the exact same time. Oh, brilliant. Well, there's plenty of flights from Alberta down to Las Vegas, but equally importantly, flights up from Houston and... the Permian, the Marcellus, all the basins where there is new pipeline construction activity. This is exactly the sort of thing that owner-operators should be taking a high interest in.
And if you're interested in reducing turnover and commissioning by about 60 to 70%,
yeah,
all that cost, and getting your actual pipeline in operation earlier and seeing that return on revenue faster.
This is the place to be.
This is the place to be. We can help you make that reality.
Make that a reality. Brad, thank you very much for taking the time today to share with me some of the challenges and insights from the construction industry, and particularly pipelines and how that world is changing. If you've enjoyed this podcast from Digital Oil and Gas, please press the like button and or leave a comment or share it with your friends so that others can find this podcast on various directories. And so we'll sign off for today and catch you all next week.
Thank you very much.
Bye for now.
If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe to the show. You can find more episodes of Digital Oil and Gas on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, and Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or just visit jeffreycann.com/podcast for more. If you have a minute, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts and tell other people about the show. This helps them discover more great content. Later this year, Jeffrey will publish a book on the impacts of digital innovation on the oil and gas industry. You can keep track of this new project by following Jeffrey on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening to this episode of Digital Oil and Gas. The podcast returns next Wednesday, so tune in then.